You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and Bricklayers and Allied Crafts Workers, Local 15. Blake and Ulig, associate advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. And in unity, there is strength. Please support workers' rights. Back, that's Bricklayers and Allied Craftsmen, Local 15, Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Republicans are again trying to pass comp time in place of overtime pay. So if they don't have to pay you, will employers actually let you have the time off when you want? We'll find out from our guests tonight. Then we had planned a show about the new airport project, but that needs to be put off until after all the negotiations are done. So in its place, we'll bring you an interview from a sister community radio station, KBOO, in Oregon, with a striking Oklahoma teacher. In the news, beware of petition gatherers making false promises and equal pay victory in federal court. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And now for the news.
Now for the news from our side. Many Kansas Cityans are familiar with the case of Saheed Jamal, the Lawrence chemist and adjunct faculty member who was arrested by ICE on his front lawn while taking his daughter to the school. Jamal got a lot of support from his friends and neighbors in Lawrence, which helped win his release from immigration jail while he mounts his case against deportation to his native Bangladesh. Not so well known is Crescencio Mendez Ramirez, a Kansas City, Kansas house painter who was arrested by ICE during a yearly check-in on February 7th. He thought he was okay, but he just received an extension on his permit to work. But there's no predicting who gets arrested in Trump's Department of Homeland Security. Mendez is a father of four young children. Two are citizens, two came at an early age along with Yasmin, their mother. Yasmin is unable to work, so Crescencio is the sole support of his family. However, he is contracted immigration jail 3 hours from Kansas City in Versailles, Missouri. His wife and kids are unable to visit because of lack of proper ID. ICE has denied releasing him on bail, like it did for Jamal, even though their cases are very similar. Immigration attorney Jessica Piedra told the Kansas City Star, Mendez Ramirez reflects thousands of working people in modest means, mostly Hispanic, who are being rounded up without making headlines. We're watching the families being torn apart. This no non-mercy attitude is shocking to a lot of people. On Tuesday, a group of people organized by AIR, Advocates for Immigration Rights, held a letter-writing event, writing to Cicio and to ICE official who could release him from jail. There was an online change.org petition and GoFundMe page for the family.
Yesterday, petition gatherers were sighted on the UMKC campus trying to entice students to sign a petition for a ballot measure to put so-called right to work, otherwise known as open shop, on the ballot, and into Missouri Constitution. They also carried a petition to ban any city from removing unpopular statues like those of Confederate generals. That was a bit ironic since the petition gatherers were black and reportedly from out of state. One of the consulting groups hired by right-wing billionaires like the Koch brothers to circulate petitions is Axiom Strategies. That's led by the notorious Jeff Rowe, who last made news for running Ted Cruz's failed presidential campaign and who has played dirty tricks in Missouri politics for years. These petition gatherers are reportedly being paid $3 to $5 per signature, plus a $1,000 bounty if they get anyone from a union to physically assault them and have it captured on video. Of course, right to work will already be on the ballot either in August or November. That's up to the Missouri legislature, and they're being coy. It will be on the ballot because unions and allies turned in more than 310,000 signatures, triple the number needed to put the issue on the ballot this year. What labor wants is for Missourians to vote no on A and repeal the law which was passed last year. Currently, the legislature is considering more attacks on unions, including wiping out Missouri's prevailing wage law, which protects construction workers from a bobsled race to the bottom in wages. The legislature is also on its way to wiping out the rights of public sector workers to organize and bargain. At a rally in March, State Senate Minority Leader Gina Walsh, who was a retired union member, told unionists that the current petition gatherers are trying to trick voters into signing by implying their petition supports collective bargaining rights. It doesn't. She warned, "Do not sign anything until you read it." Roy Gillespie Sr., a human rights commissioner for Teamsters Joint Council 13, encountered three petitioners gathering in Ferguson at a Dollar Tree store. One asked him to sign. He asked to see a copy of the petition, but was told he didn't need to read it, that it was just to create jobs in the community. When Gillespie insisted and read it, he discovered that it was the phony right-to-work petition. "Why did you lie to me?" Gillespie asked, letting him know he was a union member and didn't appreciate him lying about it. The reply, "Are you signing or not?" When Gillespie said no, the petitioner cursed him and said, "Get your old ass out of here." As Gillespie began walking to his car, all three carpetbaggers began cursing and screaming at him. "I knew they were trying to get me to fight so they could video it, but I wasn't falling for it," Gillespie told the Labor Tribune. "Have a great day," he said, and drove away. Report all sightings of the phony jobs petitioners to 573-340-6573.
In spite of the many economic and political advances, women in the United States still have to work an extra 4 months into 2018 in order to earn what men already made by New Year's Day. Equal Pay Day was celebrated on April 10th in 2018. The day was first commemorated in 1996 by the National Committee on Pay Equity, a coalition of women's and civil rights groups and labor unions that came together to raise awareness about gender pay inequity and workplace discrimination against workers based on gender. On average, in 2017, women were paid 22% less than men after controlling for race and ethnicity, age, education, and location, according to a study released by Economic Policy Institute's Elise Gould and Jessica Schneider. While April 10th is the overall Equal Pay Day, the gaps for women of color are even larger. As compared to white men, Women of color have to work even further into 2018 to make up for the wage deficit they experienced in 2017. Black Women's Equal Pay Day is August 7th. Native American Women's Equal Pay Day is September 27th. And Latina Equal Pay Day doesn't come until November 1st, almost an entire second year of working to equal typical white male wages in 2017. For more information, you can go to go.epi.org/paydata.
And following up on that same theme, on Monday, an 11-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that employers can't pay women less than men just because they made less at a previous job. The court said the continuing gender pay gap is an embarrassing reality of our economy. The court said a woman's prior salary, whether considered on its own or along with other factors, can't be used to justify paying a female employee less than her male counterpart. To do so perpetuates discrimination. The court's majority opinion was written by Judge Stephen Reinhart, and he said that, citing studies that show American women lose some $840 billion annually because of the wage gap. The court wrote, "If money talks, the message to women costs more than just billions. Women are told they are not worth as much as men." The decision was based on the Federal Equal Pay Act. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Wesley Reed of SEIU Local 1, Kip Niven of SAG-AFTRA and Actors Equity, Tino Scalisi of UAW Local 249, and I'm Judy Ansel.
All right. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. My name is Lon Swergen, and our guest is Wes Reed, a local organizer for the Service Employees International Union, Local 1. The topic tonight is comp time or overtime. Thanks for being here, Wes.
Thank you for having me.
All right. There was a bill passed in 1938 that was called the Fair Labor Standards Act. Wes, will you explain the significance of the 40-hour work week as well as the overtime pay, which that act addressed?
Sure, most definitely. Back before the act was actually put in place, people could work 40 hours, 60, 70 hours maybe, and the pay wouldn't change. And people were frustrated. They're working and they're not getting the pay that they deserve for it. So the Fair Labor Act was actually created to amend the right to minimum wage, right? It was to first create a minimum wage that people could live off of, and then secondly, create a time and a half and overtime pay for those guys who worked over the 40-hour week so that they could be compensated for the extra time that they were putting in.
So that came about, and what has happened since?
Well, what's happened since is we had Obama who came into place and tried to help push us forward by creating an overtime bill that would force employers to pay a better wage for workers who are working more hours, and also create the overtime fairness for them so they wouldn't be, you know, just staggered and at the same
right.
wages forever. Then we got the Trump administration.
Right. And what happened there?
So the Trump administration came in last year, 2017, and said, we don't want it. We're going to block it. And what actually end up happens out of this is we get the, I don't know if you want me to lead into now, the comp versus overtime.
All right, if we can go into that and then come back maybe at yeah. other parts of it. But as I've asked, basically, House or H.R. 1180, Working Families Flexibility Act of 2017, which was passed by the House May 2nd, 2017, a great-sounding bill. But what was the intention of the bill, and how does it affect the workers?
Great. You worded that perfectly. It was a great-sounding bill, right? It was supposed to not be actually in favor of the worker, but it doesn't really tell the worker that. It says Flexibility Act, which makes the worker think that he'll have more flexibility time with the family, more flexibility time especially with his pay. But it actually does the reverse opposite of that. It creates less flexibility. There's no paid leave, no paid sick days, no paid vacation, and there's no fair scheduling. And what it actually does is it says you can even have time and a half pay for your overtime, or you can change that into comp time, right, which is actually personal time needs that you may need off of work, right? Well, you know, it sounds good, like you can have extra time with the family, but most families need that extra overtime pay, especially when they're working over those 40 hours a week in order to survive. So if you think about it, you're actually giving up everything to go into this bill, right? Because it's the either or. And right now we have both, right? So you have overtime, and then you can ask for days off and be given those vacation days or those personal days off that you requested on. What this will do is actually make you required to have maybe a legislation to get off of days, right? And it also allows the employers to hold on to overtime pay from a worker as long as months, could even be years, right, before they get that money, because they're allowed to put that in a separate holding tank where they can, then choose whether or not to give that worker this money or that. And by the time they end up fighting for it, the time has already passed for them to get that pay.
Right. So how many hours can they accrue, say, the comp time?
So, say,
I've heard where it says something like there was a time when it was like 240, but now they're putting in 160.
That's what I heard, 160 hours. And that 160 hours is a lot of money.
Right.
A lot of money. And if you think about 160 hours from 100 employees, that could turn into millions of dollars.
Right, and the other part to this is that the employer basically tells the employee when he can take the time off. That would affect the idea of, well, it's slow time, what do we do? You can take your time off now. Isn't that basically how this is going to work?
You are exactly right. The flexibility that they call it doesn't really work for you, right? They tell you when you can use this time, and if you need it in a personal time where you feel like you have to have this time off, you really are not delegated that time for it, and you're not giving it. So therefore, it doesn't work for you. They hold on to it, give it to you when they feel it's right for you, rather than when you feel you need it, which is really what you want anyway.
There's an interesting thing here, because we'll go back to 1938. Yep. And what was going on then was basically they could work forever.
That's right.
In other words, they might get Sunday off, but they could work 18 hours.
That's right.
And not even have an issue there.
That's right.
And there was also something else about it, and that was about child labor, too.
Yes, perfect. So the law, the Fair Labor Act, also prohibited companies from using minors as child slaves, almost, or should we say oppressive child labor, right? Where there could be just totally all types of wrongs there.
Right.
Yes.
And that was in 1938, but he still had some of that going on in the present time.
Yes.
And there's another thing with this. The overtime, I've heard, sometimes the person doesn't get it, and he has to go through a whole mess just to get his overtime.
That's right. And so the comp versus overtime bill would just lengthen that process, which makes it even worse, right? Which means that you may never see that money or the time that you're allotted that the Flexibility Act says that you are given.
Right. So the idea is that we have, and I've seen this, because I did an interview about it, runaway inequality.
Yes.
You're basically saying that the wages flatlined since about 75 on.
Yes.
And so with this bill that Obama was trying to get through,
That's right.
was to increase that so people would have some kind of fair wage.
That's right.
And even overtime.
That's right. He tried to give the families more money and more time, right? Which ultimately is what every worker wants and what every worker family wants. But this bill, which is noted to work for that working family, really does none of the things that Obama was trying to do.
Well, this is amazing to me because we get bills that sound the opposite of what the bill does.
Yes.
And I would call that propaganda, straight out.
And
I'm sorry, but that's my feeling, yeah. Is we got the Clean Air Act,
right.
And what is it? Pollute.
That's right.
I'm sorry, but that's the way I look at it. And now we have a bill that's actually called Working Families Flexibility Act of 2017. And what they were trying to give the impression that there's so much that the family needs to do and get together with, and then you'll read it, and it's almost the opposite. Now, this is the kind of thing that we have to deal with. Is there anything else going on that we could talk about as far as, I know, it's passed in 17 in May, but it hasn't done anything in the Senate.
That's right.
Why do you think that's happening?
Well, there is some resistance out there, right?
Right.
And there are some people who are looking forward to helping out the working families people and make sure that things like this don't cripple the families.
Now, is there another thing with this? Is the 60 vote rule and a filibuster type thing on this particular bill? Would that influences too?
I imagine there will be some filibustering on this rule. I couldn't see it going without.
Right. And the idea of this has been going on. We've had this bill, the Right Act, the Fair Trade Standard Act, basically doing the right thing. And it did increase some. In other words, you realize how much was it when it first went into effect in 1938. You remember what I said?
Yeah, I believe it was somewhere along the lines of like 25 cents.
It was 25 cents, and you get a half a dollar for overtime.
Yeah.
That's how this thing worked. And it moved up gradually.
That's right.
And now we've got to fight for a minimum wage.
Right.
It's not even in the works. We put it on a ballot because why? Kansas City or St. Louis passed it, the state legislature, and this is the interesting thing is they're always saying local control.
Yeah.
They told St. Louis they couldn't do the local control.
Yes.
And that went along with us also.
Yes.
And so forth. There's something I gave you to read.
Yeah.
And I think we'll go with that.
Okay. Let me get to this quote. This quote is from William Samuel, Director of Government Affairs Department. The AFL-CIO believes workers deserve fair wages, safe working conditions, and flexible schedules to help the balance and the demands of the work and family. However, the best way to achieve these objectives is not to weaken the FLSA's protection against excessive work hours or to reduce overtime pay for workers, but rather to support the Healthy Family Act, the Paycheck Fairness Act, the Fair Minimum Wage Act, and the Schedules That Work Act, and the Paid Family and Medical Leave legislation.
So we have all these bills that are in the works.
That's right.
And all they do is come up with a bill that basically does away with that.
Yes.
Completely.
And
how do we deal with this? Do you have any idea what's going on and how we can actually call our congressmen and call our senators, or how will we do about this particular? Because it did stall in the Senate.
Yes, yes. So the first thing is what we're doing right now is having an intelligent conversation, information about what these bills actually mean, how they hurt, and how they help. Getting the correct information out to people and getting them knowledge about these bills is the first thing. The next thing is figuring out what district you stay in and
right.
who may be your senator or representative, and give that person, that congressman, a call and let them know, hey, this is what we support and this is what we believe, and we are constituents of your district.
And there's an interesting thing here is the organizing of unions and these, but also with this, it affects even an individual employee. because they have to go before the employer and ask for this before they can even do anything with it.
Yes.
And so this is a real problem.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, how do these things get off the ground?
That is a great question. Once we figure that, we might be able to stop some of those things from getting and taking lift off. But there are some people who have different ideas and different views of what working families really need.
Right. And is there any way that you know of any senator that is pushing for some of these things?
I don't know. Personally, I haven't dug in to see who actually is pushing and who actually isn't. But I would definitely call. I've called and emailed my, senator and my congressman and my district councilman. I would urge everyone to do the same thing. Find out what their views are. And question them because, they represent you, and if they're going to represent you, make sure they're doing it to the fullest.
And then while we're talking about this particular bill and the last bill in 38, we've got on the ballot something that is going to change that in a sense, and that is basically the concept of raising the minimum wage.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Until we do that, we are in real trouble.
That's right.
And so this all works in for today because this is what's happening, and we are trying to get that particular bill on the ballot for November 6th.
That's right.
And so how we do that, 2 minutes. So, is there anything else you can put into this that you can tell me more about as far as either bill?
Most definitely. What I definitely want to do is I want to hit on the minimum wage thing you said. I believe there's a petition going around to raise it by $12 an hour by 2023. And the Fair Labor Act of 1938 was definitely put in place for working families. The Flexible Act that we have going on from last year from Trump administration is not for working families. People should not opt out of it. And also talk to your constituents and your coworkers about it and make sure that they're knowledgeable about the same thing.
Okay. And so we have things that will take over as a way of changing things from the electorate rather than the Congress or the Senate or the state rep or the state senator. The people, or at least in Missouri, can do something about the issues that are affecting them.
That's right.
Which, like in Kansas, you can't do it.
That's right. Exactly.
So this is where it is.
People hold the power.
And I do appreciate, Wes, that you came here to do this for me.
No problem. Thank you so much.
And so, again, thank you. And my name's Lon Swearingen, and I thank you for listening.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death for teens, and our community is not immune. Johnson County has the highest teen suicide rate in Kansas. What should you know about teen suicide? KKFI hosts part 2 of our series on teen suicide at 7 p.m. on the Thursday night special. Experts from Johnson County Mental Health Center discuss steps that you can take to protect your teen. That's 7 p.m. on the Thursday night special, right here on KKFI.
On the next Every Woman, local authors Lisa Markley and Jill Grunwald discuss how 40 to 60% of Midwestern women have thyroid issues. Saturday at 3, right before Urban Connections.
Did you know underwriting KKFI's programming spreads the word about your organization or event and supports KKFI at the same time? Learn more at kkfi.org/underwriting.
Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Tonight we were planning on bringing you a show about the airport, the new terminal construction, multi-billion dollar project, lots of complexities, and ultimately, try as we might, we just weren't able to find anyone who was closely connected to this complex situation. So we are going to try to bring our listeners some more information sometime soon about the building trades, about construction, about barriers for minorities to get into the building trades that are really no fault of the building trades themselves. People don't generally understand, just from our research, how much of a role the employer plays in who gets hired in the building trades. So these are all really complex issues. With negotiations going on right now the way that they are, we just, as try as we might, we weren't able to get anyone who felt comfortable coming on air and talking to us right now. A lot of this is going to have to be looked at after a lot of the big decisions have been made. So luckily, we are going to bring you a interview from Oklahoma. We wanted to still do something current, something that we know a lot of people in labor are really focused on and thinking about. And we know that a lot of people right now are really interested in the teachers' activism that's been going on in Kentucky, in West Virginia, and now in Oklahoma. And so we're excited to bring you today a interview with a teacher in Oklahoma.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
And welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, this week, broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. I'm a public school teacher and host every second Monday of the month, where I typically interview teachers and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. Joining us today on the phone is Matt Miller. Matt, hello.
Hey, how are you, Stephen?
Hey, it's great to have you on. So excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, Matt, I always like to hear a little bit about teachers' background and experience before we sort of launch into whatever the specific topic is. So tell us a little bit about your teaching background.
Sure. I became an emergency certified teacher back in 2015. I actually was certified a week before school started.
Wow.
With little experience in the classroom. I graduated from the University of Oklahoma in 2012 with a political science and international relations degree, thinking that I would get in that field, and I ended up being a teacher. I currently teach world history, and I'm the head girls soccer coach here at Charles Page High School in Sand Springs, Oklahoma, just outside of Tulsa.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for that. I know in Oregon, sometimes we're a little geographically challenged when it comes to some of the other states. So it sounds like this opportunity, what happened? What inspired you to do this? You said you went and got this emergency certification to start. What inspired that?
So I'm born and raised and educated in the state of Oklahoma. When I graduated from the University of Oklahoma, I actually got into the aviation industry and was a GM of an aviation company. This kind of ties in what inspired me about this is that my family, I have one aunt, a brother, mother, stepfather, who all come from an education background.
Gotcha. Okay.
When hearing their stories and seeing their dedication, I felt to myself that You know, this is a job that reaps fulfillment in a much greater sense than I think most other jobs, most certainly the one that I was currently at.
Mm-hmm.
To have an impact, whether you know it or not, on a child, to me is very important. And so that is a very important position, which, you know, their story, their dedication, is really what inspired me to become a teacher. I took a 60% pay decrease to become a teacher because it was so inspirational, you know, around holidays, hearing my family, you know, talk about their experience as an educator.
Right. Okay. And you said 60%?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes.
So, well, let's hear a little bit more about your teaching. So now you've been doing that. This is now your fourth year?
Correct.
And what are you enjoying about it most?
Really the things that inspired me in the first place to become a teacher. You know, as a teacher, you have the opportunity, that ability to be the change and inspiration to a young mind to help build a better society. You know, what greater joy is there? You know, that's what I feel, you know, that's what I get the most out of being an educator, being a teacher, is, you know, that opportunity alone.
Yes. Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about what it's like to be teaching in Oklahoma. I mean, we've been hearing some stories. We've heard about teachers leaving, going to Texas or other states where they get paid better. We've heard about teachers mowing lawns and waiting tables. I understand that your brother, who initially was going to come on the show, had to take a shift, or he ended up taking a shift, so he couldn't come on. And I know he mentioned that you also work another job in addition to teaching and coaching. So tell us a little bit about what it's like to teach in Oklahoma. What are the hardships there?
I'm going to be brutally honest. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. My class size is not conducive. My resources are limited or non-existent. My administration is not progressive or supportive a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The overall environment is frustrating, to say the least. I have a second job on top of an extra duty stipend, and that's coaching soccer. You know, for example, today I was at my second job at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mm-hmm. leave that at about 6:30 to 7. I have, you know, an hour, maybe an hour and a half on some days to shower and get ready for, you know, my main source of income, and that's teaching.
Yep.
And then after school, I've got either soccer practice and or soccer games that, you know, depending on if it's away or not, I'm not done until, you know, anywhere from 9 to 11 o'clock in the evening to wake up at 3 to make it to my second job the next day at 4 in the morning.
Wow.
So days, you know, are long. But, you know, the situation in Oklahoma that, you know, with the state legislature, you know, hasn't passed a salary increase for teachers in the past 10 years. And you know, Oklahoma, you know, school funding per student has also plummeted by 28%
mm-hmm.
percent since 2008, more than any other state. And a lot of that ties into, again, what I said, my class size. I find myself having a class of anywhere from 35 to 37 students.
Yeah.
First day of school, I don't even have enough desks, not to mention books and technology and other resources. The resources that I do, again, are, you know, that I do have available are limited. Books that have no covers. I have to borrow Chromebooks from other teachers. My smart board doesn't even work. It's really just a projector.
Okay.
A lot of these things are, you know, very frustrating, and frustrating, I would, you know, easily say it is the current state of teaching.
Yeah. And it's kind of a double whammy, so to speak. You yourself, or teachers, I should say, are not paid a living wage. But then on top of that all, you're really struggling in school just to to be able to teach effectively given the lack of resources.
Correct. And what's even more heartbreaking is you know, the students not having that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, for those listeners who maybe haven't been following closely what's been happening, lay out what's, you sort of have laid out what's been happening leading up to the strike. You've talked some about the 28% drop in per student funding. Do you want to add anything more as far as taxes, yeah, budgets, that kind of thing, and how that led to the current situation?
Sure. So, yeah, again, the school funding per student, you know, has dropped 28% since 2008. It's more than any other state. Here in the state of Oklahoma, we spend, you know, on, you know, per prisoner, roughly around $16,000 versus roughly $8,000 per student.
So twice as much.
Yes. Since 2008, public school enrollment has increased by 40,000. Again, while the state funding has fallen, $213 million. And that kind of goes into the class size that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Oklahoma loses almost 400 teachers per month. And a lot of the tax situation, I feel, is a large part into this situation and this equation. Oklahoma taxes oil and gas at a rate, you know, far below other oil and natural gas producing states.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Even states that aren't oil and natural gas producing, the GPT, or the gross product tax, for oil and gas here in Oklahoma is only 3.2% versus roughly around 12% in the neighboring state of Arkansas, which is not an oil and gas producing state.
Gotcha.
So it's well obvious and blatant. Hence the frustrating situation that we're finding ourselves in at the moment.
Yeah. Did you follow what was going on in West Virginia?
A little bit, not as much as I would have liked. Again, long hours for me.
Sure.
Here lately.
Yeah. I just wonder if teachers in Oklahoma talked about what was happening in West Virginia, if that had an impact at all on inspiring them or maybe giving them a little more courage to go for it here.
Oh, sure. Yeah, in that sense, absolutely. Now, you know, each state is different and the issues at hand are different, but West Virginia being an inspiration for us here in Oklahoma, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about taxes and revenue for the state, how's that playing out as far as are people really getting on board as far as, hey, the only way we're going to fix this is if we raise taxes? Because sometimes that can be a losing battle, right? Especially when some of these big businesses and corporations put their money into advertising and things, they can really turn that kind of thing around and make it seem like, you know, every family is going to have their taxes raised. So how's that been playing out?
You're absolutely correct. And it's, we're, you know, starting to come around and see the writing on the wall and the issues at hand. I feel politically behind many, many years compared to other states, and we're just now seeing the writing on the wall and really where this puts us in comparison with the rest of the United States.
Yeah.
And we're getting frustrated. We're just now starting to get frustrated. The legislatures have really gotten away with quite a bit in regards to, you know, taxing the oil and natural gas. We're starting to say, hey, you know, this cannot be good. We've got to start doing something about this and more progressive. We've got to diversify our economy. and start holding, you know, larger companies more accountable in regards to taxes. We're identifying the issues. We're starting to get frustrated, which is the first step to anything in this regard. So that's kind of where we're at, and getting the legislatures to wake up as well is something that we're dealing with, and it's going to take time. It's going to take longer time than I think other states, with it being Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of where we're at right now.
So I want you to think back, and I don't know how far back it went for you, but how and when did you first hear about the idea of a statewide walkout or strike? Do you usually call it a walkout or a strike? What are you calling it?
It's been called both.
Yeah, okay.
I'm calling it a strike, but I think the initial term was a walkout.
Mm-hmm.
Leading up to the situation, we talked amongst ourselves, us educators, with mutual frustration, and that's really been building for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But we put it on the radar finally. The Oklahoma Education Association, or OEA, would eventually catch wind of it, get on board, and later email members, you know, this is how we're going to go about doing it. We've heard your frustrations. We, you know, the time is now to act. So they were the first, you know, to publicly acknowledge it and make a set of demands, along with a set of policies to go along, you know, to make those demands happen. Soon, you know, of course, social media would take place and follow that. Social media pages such as Oklahoma Teacher Walkout,
mm-hmm,
is a really good one. I think it, in a matter of overnight, increased its followers, I think, like 50,000.
Alberto, he's a pretty popular guy now.
He is very popular, and he's, you know, to the point. He's professional, respectful, and you know, also at the end of the day, fed up just like all of us, and, mm-hmm, and to the point. We're lucky to have him fighting for our cause, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Labor Radio. I've got Matt Miller from Oklahoma. Let's talk for just a minute about the demands of this strike. A lot of attention gets paid to teacher pay, teacher salary, but there are additional demands, right? Increasing taxes on the state's oil and gas industry, like you mentioned, so that schools can do things like provide new textbooks, or so that you can bring your class sizes down to a more reasonable, manageable number of students. What do you think of the demands as they were laid out? Do you feel like, are you asking for too much? Do you wish that you had demanded more?
So the demand is give teachers a $10,000 pay increase, around $200 million in funding for education, and an additional $5,000 raise for support staff. I feel this is awfully nice and not asking too much.
Mm-hmm.
These demands are not only, you know, they don't only get us caught up, but unfortunately, these are demands that the state legislature has failed to do or address for decades. These demands still put us behind and not competitive with surrounding states. So these demands are really only a starting point, it's still not enough. We're just the initial steps. So,
yeah,
you know, baby steps is the way that I see it. But I think that the demands that OEA and the teachers are really fighting for are respectable. I don't feel that it's not too much. You know, with the current state the way it is, you know, anything is better than what we're getting right now.
Yep.
So I can't say it's too low.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it's awfully nice and not
asking too much.
Okay.
To be competitive with our surrounding states, to fund our child in their education process. I just don't. That's I think not too much to ask for.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, despite his hopes, they just announced today that the strike is over after 9 days. Alicia Priest, who is the head of the Oklahoma Education Association, basically said that she did not think that they were going to get any more out of the legislature, and so they were going to have to transfer the battle to the ballot box in the November elections to try to get more money for education, but the teachers are going back to work. And now stay tuned for Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel.
Once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff who made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys...
I'm Arianna Eckel. Thousands of teachers are on strike all across Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona, inspired by the West Virginia teacher strikes earlier this year. Even the school district I graduated school from in rural Oklahoma is on strike. Tonight, I want to provide you with some historical background to current teacher unrest. Teachers first organized the forerunner to the National Education Association way back in 1857. Instead of focusing on classroom issues and wages, they pushed for standardizing career entry requirements and campaigned to make the profession of teaching more prestigious. They believed this would lead to an increase in wages in proportion with public esteem and legislative support. Initially, most members were male school administrators. Many classroom teachers believed that teachers should organize their own labor unions. This was beyond the scope of the NEA, so teachers set about organizing their own unions. Margaret Haley and Catherine Goggin founded the Chicago Teachers Federation in 1897 and in 1902 affiliated with Chicago Federation of Labor. Teachers in other areas organized as well, and as victims of their period of history, they often divided into locals based upon gender and race. In 1916, some Chicago Teachers Union locals joined with a few other locals to form the American Federation of Teachers, with Chicago as its first headquarters. The NEA and AFT continued along their different trajectories for most of the rest of the 20th century. The Red Scare of World War I proved to be a significant setback to labor, especially the AFT. The police struck in Boston in 1919, and the chaos that resulted led to many states and municipalities banning public sector workers from striking, including teachers. Then the Great Depression saw a huge increase in labor unrest, organizing, and strikes, and this spirit of rebellion was caught also by teachers. The Wagner Act was passed in 1935 and guaranteed the right to collectively bargain to private sector employees, but large numbers of workers, such as teachers, were excluded by the act. The labor movement of the era was divided between those who wanted to remain with the more conservative craft-oriented American Federation of Labor and others who favored the more radical industrial unionism of the new Congress of Industrial Organizations. AFT membership was similarly divided, though membership grew dramatically throughout the 40s. It was then that some teachers began participating in the massive waves of strikes that raged across the United States after the World War II price controls expired and wages failed to improve proportionately. The lack of legal protection for strike activities, coupled with the second Red Scare with the onset of the Cold War, took a harsh toll on the AFT, and it lost much of its militancy and a good deal of its membership. By contrast, the NEA's continued emphasis on professionalism protected it from the worst of it. Around the same time, female teachers successfully organized and managed to get 97% of school districts to pay based upon a scale, ending a long practice of paying female teachers less. The next few decades saw an improvement in the public's image of unionism, and the country benefited. In 1959, Wisconsin passed a law granting the right to organize to the state's public sector workers, though it still prohibited them from striking. In 1960, area AFT leaders organized many New York City AFT locals into the United Federation of Teachers, UFT, and organized a large, successful strike that won them collective bargaining rights. This campaign was so wildly successful that the AFT itself abandoned its no-strike clause the same year. Inspired by the UFT, teachers across the country struck and collectively bargained to advance their causes, and the AFT grew in membership and esteem. In 1954, the AFT supported the Brown v. Board of Education decision, and its opposition to racially segregated locals helped drive this momentum. The AFT grew so successful that the NEA started to study and model their success. According to historian John F. Lyons, the country experienced over 1,000 teacher strikes involving more than 823,000 teachers between July of 1960 and June of 1974. Both the NEA and AFT were wildly successful throughout the 1970s, and at their peak, they together represented 72% of public school teachers. Competition drove the two organizations to resemble one another, and twice they almost merged into a single organization. Of course, everything changed in 1981 with the aftermath of the PATCO strike. President Ronald Reagan fired over 10,000 striking air traffic controllers. This saw a general cooling in labor militancy and unionization rates. Unions, including the teachers, began to focus more on legislative strategies than on strikes, and workers enjoyed the collective bargaining rights they had previously won. The relative labor peace ended in 2008 with the arrival of the Great Recession and the comorbid attack on public sector workers' rights with austerity. Teachers and other public workers organized a massive uprising in Wisconsin in response to the attacks on them there, and limited teacher strikes have continued intermittently to this day. Teachers are enjoying tremendous community support in their struggles, and I can't wait to see how their story continues to play out. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. On Friday, tomorrow, April 13th, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., there is a march and rally for peace, and this is to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King. They will be meeting and beginning at 5:30 at 34th and Paseo at the Victorious Life Church, and they will march to 7th and Prospect. The rally will begin at 7 o'clock at Morningstar Baptist Church, 2411 East 27th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, you can email the sponsors of this at peace4kc@yahoo.com. On Saturday, April 14th, there's civil disobedience training for the Poor People's Campaign. This is from noon to 2 p.m. at Westport Presbyterian Church, 201 Westport Road, KCMO. RSVP to Stand Up KC on Facebook. Tuesday, May 8th, Honduras Resists the Empire, a talk by Karen Spring of the Honduras Solidarity Network at Rockhurst Community Center, 5401 Troost, at 7 p.m. Workers Revival Festival, May 11th and 12th, 2 days of music and art celebrating working class power, sponsored by Jobs with Justice and Blacksite Records. This will be at the Record Bar in Kansas City, Missouri, and stay tuned. We'll have more information. And for your long-term planning, June 21st to 24th is the 2018 Great Labor Arts Exchange. It will be at the ATU Tommy Douglas Conference Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And for more information, go to laborheritage.org. That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. You can find our calendar on our website at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to have highlights from the Labor Notes Conference that occurred last weekend, as well as we're going to be having Bill Fletcher talk about right to work. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn, for a valiant effort of a complicated show. Thanks, Keith. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is about teen suicide. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
You're tuned.